I'm very happy to begin the program by welcoming Jonathan Bratter here. He's a counsel with the Democracy Program of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on the program tonight.
Thanks so much for having me on.
First of all, tell our listeners briefly about the work you do at the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center.
Sure. Well, we have a voting rights and elections project here, which is devoted to ensuring free, fair, and accessible elections. And we accomplish that in a variety of ways. In some cases, it's litigation, lawsuits to try to block restrictive voting laws. We also do advocacy in legislatures, in Congress, and in the media to try to push for more voter-friendly policies. And we also do quite a bit of research and work in a sort of think tank capacity to try to study what's going on in voting across the country.
All right. And the website for the Brennan Center is simply brennancenter.org. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. We'll mention that again before we conclude. Jonathan, we wanted to have you here tonight to talk about some recent developments in terms of defending voting rights. There was a spate of litigation in many states trying to challenge restrictive voting laws in a number of Republican Party-controlled states, such as Ohio. And there was a recent Supreme Court decision, in fact, it was last Monday, where the Supreme Court let stand a request from the Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted, to delay a lower federal court order restoring a reduction in time allotted for early voting in the state in the election here the first Tuesday in November, the midterm elections that I guess most people are aware of is coming up. But maybe you can talk about that particular Supreme Court decision and how it fits into other challenges across the country that are trying to roll back some of these restrictive voting laws that have gone into effect in the last couple of years.
Sure. Well, in Ohio this year, the legislature tried to basically cut early voting. Early voting, the opportunity to cast ballots, in the days and weeks before Election Day, is something that is really, until recently, more and more states have been doing it. It was very popular with voters, very popular with election administrators. In fact, a bipartisan panel that the president convened to study voting issues recommended early voting. So this is a really a common sense reform that a lot of states were using. The Ohio legislature moved to cut a week of early voting, including what was referred to in Ohio as Golden Week, which is a time when you could register and vote at the same time. So this was obviously very important for voter mobilization efforts. Early voting in Ohio was also something in recent years that a lot of minority voters had taken advantage of, especially the Sunday before Election Day. It was a very popular opportunity for things like Souls to the Polls drives, which are very popular, for example, in African American churches. And after the Ohio legislature moved to cut a week of early voting, federal court had held that the cut to early voting would have to be blocked because of some of the harmful effects it might have, particularly on minority voters. And right before that restored week of early voting was about to begin, the Supreme Court, without an opinion, just reversed it. So as of now, that early voting week is not available. In terms of the nationwide picture, I mean, this Ohio case is just one of a number of ongoing court battles that really could shape what the voting landscape looks like. There's also ongoing lawsuits in Texas, Wisconsin, North Carolina, the case involving Kansas and Arizona. So even though we're only a few weeks out from this midterm election, there's a lot of moving parts, and we're not sure what kind of landscape voters are going to face in a lot of these states.
When it comes to Ohio, it should be noted that it's an important state given its role, especially in presidential elections, where Ohio is viewed by many political pundits and both political parties as key to winning the presidency. Now, in this November's election, it's not a presidential race, but nonetheless, these voter restriction rules will certainly impact the election in 2016. And I think, as you indicated, the Supreme Court decision here was to let stand the stay, allowing these restrictions to remain for this election. But the entire court will take this up presumably after November, or is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of these lawsuits are going to continue on after the election. So a lot of what we're seeing now are rulings on injunctions or sort of temporary rules to either block laws from going into effect or, you know, restore laws that have been struck down by lower courts. So a lot of this litigation is going to continue after 2014. What happens before the election is of particular interest right now because as we're heading into this midterm election, there's 22 states that have tougher rules than they did in the last midterm, the 2010 midterm. And in fact, 15 states, 2014 will be the first major election, the first federal election, that have these new restrictions in place. And so in terms of, it certainly has a lot of importance for 2016 as well, but we're keeping a close eye on a lot of these cases because there's going to be so many voters potentially going to the polls for the first time with these new restrictions in place.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of eyes are on the potential change in power in the U.S. Senate, which is you know, a big deal and potentially has some major impact on policies in Washington, federal policies. Jonathan Breder, tell us a little bit about what's going on in Wisconsin, because it was kind of an odd set of federal court decisions where voting rules flip-flopped to the point where it gave those folks who are implementing those rules in the Secretary of State's office in Madison very little time to switch gears preparing for this election in November. You want to just mention quickly about that set of circumstances?
Yes, well, Wisconsin passed a restrictive voting law as well. It cut back early voting. It also put in place a very restrictive voter ID law. There was one piece of evidence that showed that there are 300,000 people statewide in Wisconsin that don't have the ID they need for that law. So this is certainly something that could have a serious effect on this election. There had been a number of lawsuits filed against that in both state and federal court, until recently, there had been a federal court ruling in place that was going to block the voter ID law from going into effect for this election because the court had found there were constitutional problems with it. It also found that it violated the Voting Rights Act, then another federal court basically overruled that and said that the law could go into effect, again, pretty close to the election. That is sort of still working its way through the courts. The federal appellate court that had allowed the law to go into effect just issued a written opinion today, and currently the Supreme Court is deciding whether or not it's going to act in this case. So this is another case, again, where as we approach the election, it's still unclear exactly what's going to happen for voters.
And Jonathan, just for some context here, a lot of the new restrictive voting laws that have gone into effect occurred because of the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, the Federal Voting Rights Act, on the part of the U.S. Supreme Court, where certain sections that allowed preemptive action on the part of the Justice Department to intervene if voting laws would disproportionately disenfranchise minority voters, for instance, they would have the capacity to delay implementation until further review. But maybe you could talk about how the Supreme Court's ruling on the Voting Rights Act has really changed the environment here in terms of voting rules across the country.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, so, I mean, if you look at sort of the current wave of restrictive laws, it really started in 2010. That's when we started to see lots and lots of restrictive laws passed across the country. Initially, the Voting Rights Act, as you said, was a very important part of blocking some of those laws from going into effect. So the Department of Justice and courts had put a lot of those laws on hold under a provision called Section 5, which was passed originally to make sure that states that have a history of discrimination in voting against racial minorities have to show that basically that their laws aren't going to have a discriminatory effect before they can be allowed to implement those laws. Initially a lot of these laws had been blocked. But last summer, the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. They effectively invalidated this Section 5 preclearance measure. And right after that happened, a lot of states moved to put restrictive laws in place. In fact, of the 15 states that used to be closely monitored under the Voting Rights Act, nine of those passed new restrictions. Again, these are states with a history of discrimination. And in some cases, it was literally hours later. For example, in Texas, in a case that we're continuing to litigate, they put their voter ID law in place hours after the Voting Rights Act was gutted in this way. In North Carolina, soon after Section 5 was taken away, passed a really wide-reaching restrictive law that, you know, cut early voting, put an ID law in place. So these certainly not having that preclearance remedy available has made it harder to stop some of these restrictive laws from going into place.
Thanks for that. We're speaking tonight here on Counterpoint with Jonathan Breiter. He's counsel with the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. And Jonathan, as you just said, since 2010, Republican-controlled state legislators around the country have passed bills to limit early voting, impose new obstacles to voter registration, and restrictive voter ID laws. I wonder if you could review for our listeners the net effect that these laws may have on disenfranchising, particularly minority voters, in this coming election. I know there's been some studies about how these laws will affect turnout in the next election and how that could actually change the outcome of some contests state by state.
Yeah, well, when these laws first passed in 2000, sort of in the lead up to the 2012 election, we estimated at that time that up to 5 million Americans could have a harder time voting because of these restrictions. Because of the ongoing litigation and because of some changes in state laws, we don't know exactly what the effect will be for this election. But some of the figures we've seen from some of these lawsuits suggest it could be a pretty serious effect. For example, in Texas, where we're currently challenging their voter ID law in court, the evidence showed that 1.2 million Texans don't have the ID that's needed by this law, and that includes 600,000 registered voters. And the impacts don't fall evenly. Hispanic voters are more than three times likely to not have that ID in Texas. Black voters are more than twice as likely not to have that ID when compared with whites. And that's just one example. If you look at some of the other restrictions, like cutting back on early voting, the backlash against early voting is something that's happened, particularly in the South and the Midwest, after African Americans started using early voting at sort of higher rates. We've seen, for example, in states like Florida, after African Americans and Latinos used early voting at higher rates, legislatures moving to cut that. Another example is cutting back on voter registration drives. Voter registration drives by groups like the League of Women Voters, Rock the Vote, other organizations are very important for and have been very important for closing the registration gap on between racial groups. And so we've also seen states moving to make those registration drives harder. So there's a whole variety of ways that some of these restrictions are not falling evenly in terms of their impacts across racial lines.
And is there any way to estimate the number of people who will not be able to vote this November and in future elections as a result of these laws?
Well, it is. As I said, it's a little tricky to quantify it exactly, in part because we don't know exactly what the outcome of these cases will be. When we took a comprehensive look at it and when most of these laws were passed, our estimate of about 5 million people at that time was based on the number of people who didn't have access to ID, the number of people who voted early or registered on Election Day, for example, in a state that had cut Election Day registration. So you have to sort of look at the way that voters have used some of these opportunities to cast ballots that might be taken away from them.
Now, Jonathan, as we've talked about in this program a number of times, is that the rationale for many of these restrictive voting laws is that Republicans, they purport to be defending the integrity of their election systems in these states by claiming that there's massive fraud and that these restrictive laws must go into effect to prevent future fraud. But any studies, any you know, neutral party taking a look at the factor of voter fraud in our elections finds literally none that would impact the results of any elections. And I wondered if you would comment on the allegations of fraud and their veracity.
Well, you will see this sometimes as justification. In reality, voter ID laws don't prevent fraud that occurs on any significant scale. If you look at in-person voter impersonation, which is the only kind of improper activity that an ID law would stop, that's virtually non-existent. The real fraud that we've seen, frankly, is politicians trying to manipulate the rules to make it harder for certain people to vote. Now, obviously, we do want secure elections. Everybody wants our election process to have, you know, the highest amount of integrity. And there are ways to make our elections more secure. One way to do it is to modernize voter registration. One of the real election administration problems we do have are sloppy and out-of-date voter rolls, because, you know, people may have moved, they may have died or whatever, and the voter rolls can become out of date. If we can modernize a registration system with things like transferring registration information electronically, helping people keep their voter registration up to date when they move, having online registration and tools like that to help keep the rolls accurate and up to date, that can really do a much better job of keeping our election system secure than some of these misguided laws we've seen in recent years.
And it goes without saying that while the Republicans are claiming that these laws are being imposed to prevent voter fraud, the fact is that many political observers have claimed that this is nakedly an attempt to gain partisan party advantage at the polls. In fact, it was in the spring of 2012, for example, Pennsylvania House Majority Leader Mike Terzi told a gathering of Republicans that their voter identification law would allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania in that presidential election. And there are other examples of Republican activists or politicians, basically admitting that this is all a device to prevent people who support Democrats from getting to the polls. What are your observations about the motivation here, Jonathan?
Well, I mean, there certainly have been some troubling statements. You mentioned one. Another one, there was a Georgia state senator who said that, you know, putting an early voting site in a black neighborhood was a partisan move and that he was going to eliminate the loophole that allowed that to happen. There was an Ohio official that said, we shouldn't change the rules to accommodate the, quote, urban voter turnout machine. There are some certainly some troubling individual examples out there. And it is true that if you look at the trends, there definitely are partisan trends when it comes to this. Of the 22 states I mentioned that have new restrictions, 18 of those passed through entirely Republican-controlled bodies. There was a UMass Boston study that said that found that restrictions were more likely to pass as the proportion of Republicans in the legislature increased or when a Republican governor was elected. So those trends are there. I mean, we've also observed that racial demographic factors can trigger these laws. If you look at the 11 states, for example, that had the highest African-American turnout in 2008, and of course that was an election where there was sort of famously, a huge surge in participation among communities of color. But if you look at those 11 states with the highest African-American turnout in 2008, 7 of those have new restrictions in place now. If you look at the 12 states that had the largest Hispanic population growth in the 2010 census, 9 of those have new restrictions in place. So there are trends here that suggest, that there are partisan and racial factors in play.
Those are some powerful stats to suggest the motivation right there. Well, Jonathan, before we conclude, I wanted to get your take on this. In your view, what is the antidote to all these states really setting up an uneven playing field for voters, where in one state it's going to be a lot more difficult to vote than in the state next door? It just seems like we have a horrible mess in terms of voting rights in this country at the moment. Is federal legislation possible to create some basic standards or a threshold to make sure, the largest number of people can get to the polls without obstruction?
I think that there are a couple ways to fix it. One is we definitely do need action at the federal level. First of all, Congress has to act to restore the Voting Rights Act. The way the Supreme Court has gutted the law It's going to take congressional action to basically fix Section 5 to restore this key civil rights protection. There are also some just common sense reforms that can be put in place at the federal level. I mentioned before a bipartisan panel that had Obama and Romney's top election lawyers recommended a lot of common sense fixes, including things like modernizing voter registration that Congress can act to put in place for federal elections. So that's definitely one way to address the problem. Another thing we've seen that's actually very encouraging is that a lot of states are passing positive laws, including laws that modernize registration, some states expanding early voting and putting other pro-voter reforms in place. So one thing that people should definitely do is push for pro-voter reforms in the states. And then we've also just seen, you know, voters really do push back against these things. In 2011, for example, when legislators tried to cut election day registration in Maine, there was a ballot initiative to overturn that. We've seen in North Carolina where there was a harsh and sweeping registration restriction. There's been a huge uprising, including the Moral Mondays movement that have been talking about these election issues extensively. And there's been a big voter engagement push. You know, one thing to really keep in mind is that, you know, if politicians are passing these unfair voting laws and trying to manipulate the system, the answer is to understand the rules in your state, make sure you're registered, make sure you show up and vote, and help other people do the same.
Good advice, and thank you so much, Jonathan, for making time for our discussion tonight and the important work you do at the Brennan Center for Justice. Just my own two cents here as we conclude, I would love nothing more than for international observers to descend on the United States state by state and really, you know, give a hard look at what restrictions are in place in these various states, and to provide some kind of report card on the status of democracy in our country, which in my mind has deteriorated horribly. And, you know, the United States runs around the world telling other nations that we're the beacon of democracy, but our democracy is a very sick entity at the moment with all these restrictive laws in place. But, Jonathan, any concluding remarks here, or certainly just give our listeners, if you would, the website so people can get more information about the studies you talked about tonight and the work you're doing at the Brennan Center.
Sure. Well, you can go to our website at brennancenter.org. That's B-R-E-N-N-A-N, center.org. One resource that people might find helpful is a student voting guide we have on our website, which is an interactive tool you can use. You know, it's designed for students, but really anyone can benefit from it if you want to see what the rules are for registration, if your state has a voter ID law, things like that. So that's one thing I would definitely point people towards in the upcoming election. And, you know, the other thing is just, you know, you can use that and just know what the rules are in your state. If you're in, you know, if you're listening to this program, you live in New York, the registration deadline is October 10th, this Friday. In Connecticut, you have a little more time. There are different options depending on how you want to register. But make sure you figure out what those rules are in your state. You know, again, check out that student voting guide and everything else we have at brennancenter.org.
All right. The valuable information. Thank you so much, Jonathan. We'll stay in touch on this and the other issues you're working on.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Take care. Good night. That's Jonathan Bratter. He's a counsel with the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice in New York City, based in New York City.